Welcome and good evening. Okay, I'm Fairfax Doran, Executive Director and co-founder of Ballroom Morpha, for those who do not know me. I'm actually curious, how many people are from out of town? Raise your hand. Wow, that's pretty good. Did we get that count, Ham? Okay. Anyways, I see many familiar faces from earlier today, and we've had some really fantastic discussions covering, how art can impact change, also the science behind global warming, and now we're going to be talking about sustainability and how we can contribute to change. Before we begin, I hope everyone can join us tomorrow. This is not the end. We have much more to look forward to in the final day of this year's Morpha Dialogue. Tomorrow, we'll start the morning with a nature walk and a brunch on the Mims Ranch, which is just north side of town, and which is associated with the Dixon Water Foundation. Then following a reading by Rebecca Solnit and at the Morpha Book Company, and then a presentation on how to create a low-carbon economy with Tom Rann. We will close the weekend with an inspiring performance by artist Cynthia Hopkins at the Crowley Theater, not to be missed either. And again, I want to recognize our many fantastic partners who have truly helped make this event happen. And we could not have done it without the Morpha Public Radio, who is not only been an incredible media partner with broadcasting all of these talks on the radio, but also been doing some fantastic interviews as well. And the Morpha Book Company and the Big Bend Sentinel, the Washington Spectator, as well as the Dixon Water Foundation. And we are enormously grateful to our lead sponsor, the Rauschenberg Foundation, has enabled us to make Carbon 13, the visual arts exhibition that's on view right now at Ballroom Morpha, and the Morpha Dialogues happen. And we're also enormously grateful for all the generous support from the many, many contributors, which I must name because we wouldn't be here without them as well. Hold on. We have support from the Andy Warhol Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Texas Commission on the Arts, as well as the Brown Foundation, the Public Concern Foundation, the Foundation for Contemporary Arts, Frederica Hunter, and the Dixon Water Foundation, and also our members. I also want to recognize our staff. The staff, we have an incredible team. They are just extraordinary people, and I hope everyone, thank you for giving them that round of applause. Begin this evening, I would like to introduce Hamilton Fish, who will be in conversation with Michael Pollan to talk more about our subject in dealing with climate change and sustainability. And Hamilton Fish is a dear friend, but he's also a publisher of the Washington Spectator, a social entrepreneur and an environmental advocate, and a film producer. And Fish actually first partnered with Ballroom Morpha on the Morpha Dialogues in 2010, which focused on issues dealing with the border. And he's also the president of the Public Concern Foundation. And we are also very grateful. I want to introduce Michael Pollan and Hamilton Fish, which this has been co-presented by the Dixon Water Foundation, which we're entirely grateful for. And here, I'm going to give it to you, Hammond. We're honored to have the award-winning author, journalist, and activist, Michael Pollan. Thank you.
Right here. Thank you, Fairfax. That applause was surely for Michael, but maybe a little applause for Fairfax and the extraordinary job that she's done. Let me just start with a couple of housekeeping notes. Please remember to silence your cell phones. This evening's conversation is being broadcast live over Marfa Public Radio, and videotape hopefully will be available on the Ballroom Marfa and Washington Spectator websites in the coming weeks. There will be a book signing at the conclusion of tonight's program, and copies of Michael's books are available for purchase from the Marfa Book Company in the lobby of the theater. So for the past 25 years, Michael Pollan has been writing books and articles about the places where nature and culture intersect. On our plates, in our farms and gardens, and in the built environment. Most of you are acquainted with his four New York Times bestsellers, Food Rules, In Defense of Food, The Omnivore's Dilemma, The Botany of Desire. In 2003, he was appointed the Knight Professor of Journalism at University of California, Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. His books and the articles they have spawned have earned him a stack of awards and honors higher than the Davis Mountains. In 2010, Michael was named to the Time 100 magazine's annual list of the world's most influential people. Yet, in his capacity as a university professor at Berkeley this fall, he faces his greatest professional challenge. Our youngest daughter, Sophia, is in his class. So please join me in giving a warm Marfa welcome to Michael Pollan.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Before you start, can I just say something? I just want to thank everybody. First, Ham, for inviting me to Marfa. I never would have come if not for him, his reaching out and twisting arms so effectively. But also to the people I've met at Marfa. I've just had such, Judith and I, my wife, have had such a warm welcome. It's completely overturned my stereotypical take on Texas. I had no idea what a progressive place Texas is.
Now, would you compare your reception in Marfa favorably to the one you got in Lubbock?
This is much warmer. I had a kind of chilly reception in Lubbock, actually. I was invited there to speak, and you know, there's a big ag school there, and somebody thought it'd be a good idea that I'd mix it up a little bit with the industrial ag people there. But the woman who invited me got in a lot of hot water, apparently, about the invitation once it got out. I was supposed to be the president's lecturer. The president didn't show up. And for the dinner that usually, then I was told I could speak, but not about agriculture. I should speak about writing. And then they offered equal time to someone from the industry. So he got to talk about agriculture. And then for the dinner after the lecture, I was dropped off in front of the Chipotle near my hotel. So that's not going to happen tonight, right?
Was there anything in a Chipotle that is on your list of approved ingredients?
Absolutely, yeah. No, the pork at Chipotle is very good. It's either a Niman Ranch pork, which is sustainably raised, and very often it's local pork. I don't know about in Lubbock, but yeah. No, their pork, their carnitas burrito, although it has it's huge and has way too many calories.
Well, I think there's an interest in our town, too, in the writing topic. And I thought maybe to get started, we'd go back a little bit in terms of personal history. And if you could just tell us a little bit about how you made your way onto this terrain.
Yeah, well, I never set out to write about food. That was not my plan. I didn't have much of a plan. I actually didn't think becoming a writer was a realistic ambition. I loved writing. I loved the idea of being a writer, but it didn't seem like something you could make a living doing. So I did what to me was the next best thing, which is going to publishing. And I worked in magazines, in a succession of magazines. That's where we first crossed paths in New York publishing circles. And while I was at, and I wrote about some different things while I worked at magazines. I wrote about television for a while, and nobody seemed to notice, or you know, the people who watched television then didn't read at all, and vice versa. The people who read didn't watch television. That's changed, actually. And I wrote about technology and a few other topics. But while I was at Harper's, I was working for Lewis Lapham, who you know well, right? And it was, like the nation, it was impossible to get a decent raise in that place. And you know, every year you get 1 or 2%, and you were supposed to be grateful. And you just couldn't get anywhere. And so one year I asked Lewis if, in lieu of a raise, would he publish one of my articles and work with me on it and edit it and that kind of thing. And he did. And that first article was about my kind of misadventures in the garden. I've always been interested in raising food in the garden. And I brought to, this is a slightly long story, sorry, but when I started gardening, I was in my, restarted gardening, I'd done it when I was an 8-year-old, but when I started doing it in my late 20s, Judith and I bought this kind of rundown sliver of an old dairy farm in Northwest Connecticut. And I came to the garden as a child of Thoreau. You know, that's what I studied in graduate school. I went to graduate school in English, and I loved Thoreau and Emerson and that whole wonderful American tradition of writing about nature, wild nature, the untrammeled landscape, the landscape that you worship. And if you garden, if you endeavor to get a little food out of the earth, those ideas are really dangerous because you will do things like, oh, I don't want a fence. That would be so alienated from nature. Oh, I don't have to worry about the pests. And so I got into this whole engagement with the natural world, which consisted, I mean, that's a fancy way of saying one night a woodchuck came out and, you know, wiped out my entire garden. And it led me to this kind of Bill Murray-esque war with this woodchuck, in which I kind of escalated. It was sort of my personal horticultural Vietnam. I just kind of started out with the send in a few advisors phase, which was, you know, read everything I can about woodchucks and figure out that they don't like to have their belly fur dirty, so maybe pour some creosote in the hole, and but then he dug a way around it and started taking out the garden again, and then I did some kind of more mean things, like I found a dead woodchuck on the road, a kind of a squashed one, and I got a piece of cardboard and I scooped him up and I jammed that in the hoping, you know, to intimidate him. What was that program in Vietnam? The special force
pacification.
Yeah. And up it up and went until I found myself doing something that, in retrospect, I can't believe I did, which was I had seen this video on TV. They were testing a new fuel for airliners to reduce the risk of fire after a crash. And they showed this footage. They'd gone to some airport in the middle of nowhere, and they found this fuselage of some old 707, and they deliberately started a fire. And they set up a camera, and you could watch the flames just racing down the length of the fuselage. And I thought, this is exactly what I want to happen down in that burrow. It didn't work, by the way. The fuel additive didn't work. So I poured a couple gallons of gasoline down the hole, and I had this idea that I would just light a match, and the fire would race through and incinerate the woodchuck. I mentioned I studied English, though, not physics. And had I studied physics, I would have known that fire does not like to go away from oxygen. No, it doesn't like that at all. So when I struck that match and threw it in, this fountain of flames came out at me and threw me back. And I had lots of hair then. And I kind of had this, you know, this was my epiphany. I mean, that there's something wrong with our assumptions about the natural world.
Michael,
and that
I think you're a pretty good example of one of those rare people for whom the choice of a career in journalism was a good move.
I think that's right.
I have
trouble with doing things.
Before we go too much further, I want to offer a long overdue apology. I realize in your account that before you got to Harper's, we'd reached a kind of reckoning in New York publishing, and there was a famous lunch with Calvin Trillin, and Victor Navasky. Trillin had been hired to write a column at The Nation, not unlike your arrangement with Harper's, and he was fighting for more compensation. And after an hour of tussle, Navasky agreed to the high two figures.
Yeah.
and this became the standard for at the top end of New York journalism for a number of years. So for you and Judith, any of the financial hardship you may have experienced is
Victor
partly
can be blamed.
So
I published my account of that in Harper's,
right.
And that led to a series of essays.
It was a standoff pretty much with the woodchuck?
I finally got a fence. I got a solar-powered electric fence, and I was able to kind of do this little bit of jiu-jitsu and defeat him, for that season. But, what happened was I realized that usually when Americans go to think about nature and their relationship to nature, we go to the wild, we go to the woods, we go to the desert. But my bet as a writer was that going to the garden or the farm would have just as much to teach us about how to negotiate this very vexed and complex relationship. And so did a series of pieces on gardening that were, there was a little bit about food there, but that got me into thinking about genetically modified food and got me thinking about monocultures and brought me into the work of Wendell Berry. And, suddenly, if you're really interested in those messy places where the natural world and the human world have to mix it up, you're going to get to food eventually, because we need to change the land. We need to change the composition of species. We need to do a lot in order to feed ourselves. So in retrospect, it was inevitable, but it was never the plan.
So this personal journey coincides, interestingly, with the emergence of an American food movement. So from your perch today, looking back, can you trace the origins of that movement?
Mm. Yeah, one of the things that's really struck me in writing about food politics today is that this conversation really began in the 70s. And it was kind of aborted with, I think, Reagan's election in 1980. But you go back and you look at the kind of things I'm writing and Eric Schlosser is writing and all the different people working on this issue, and you find much of it prefigured in the work of Wendell Berry. But also people you don't know as well, such as Joan Gussow, was writing a lot then. So we started this conversation, especially about the environmental implications of the way we're raising food. And and Wendell Berry had a lot to do with that in The Unsettling of America, where he took a good hard look at agriculture. And during the Carter administration, there were some very progressive people in the Department of Agriculture, and there was the beginning of a rethinking of especially the amount of energy that goes into our food. Oh, Barry Commoner was writing about this too in the 70s. And then it was kind of forgotten about. So I think what sort of happened when it came back, and I date the modern interest really to the publication of Fast Food Nation. I think that was a very important event. And the mad cow disease issue and the jack in the box. Food safety problems have had a lot to do with raising the profile of the issue.
While there may have been a hiatus in the political debate, in your state there was a retail movement. Restaurants were increasingly introducing a California-branded approach to eating that relied on local sourcing, on seasonal...
Organic, too.
Organic. And it did have a distinctive character, and at the time it was greeted as a dramatic new introduction into American cuisine.
Yes, and that's another important, you're alluding to Alice Waters and her role. She was one of those characters in the 70s who began, I think the restaurant opens, Chez Panisse opens in 71, and she starts sourcing food organically, basically because she was looking for a certain taste that she couldn't get in conventional produce. But she starts shining the light of her glamour on farmers, giving them credit on menus, which we think of as this cliche now, but that was a pretty radical idea and actually she had a lot to do with the reevaluation of farming as a career for a lot of people, because they'd been demeaned for decades. And that spread, yeah, as a consumer movement.
It spread from her kitchen. It spread. They started new restaurants.
Every city, you know, within a few years had a farm-to-table restaurant, farmers market movements. Yeah, so even though it kind of went underground in terms of the political debate, it was spreading as a consumer choice. And you had a series of events. You had the Alar scare, so-called, in 1990. And that, too, you remember that was about apples. It was a 60 Minute. I think we have some people from 60 Minutes. They were instrumental in promoting that story. And Alar was a chemical that was being put on apples to speed their ripening, I believe. And it was found to be a carcinogen. And there was Panic for Organic was the headline in Newsweek magazine. And every wave of growth in organic food was driven by, really, a food safety scare.
So when does this start to penetrate in the market? When do we see organics in the supermarket?
Well, it got a big boost when the federal government passed a law in, I think it was it 90? It took them 10 years to write the rules. There was an act passed in Congress that established the National Organic Program. We had an organic label, but every state, sometimes every locality, had their own certifying organization. And the standards were slightly different around the country. And there was some concern about fraud. There were a couple cases of fraud, of people labeling things as organic that weren't. So a law was passed to establish an organic program, and about 10 years was spent writing these rules. And then they went into effect in 2001, I believe it was. And that gave a kind of confidence to big national retailers that they could follow this set of rules, which, by the way, they had helped to write, and they would be able to sell the same food as organic all over the country. And so then you get the big players. General Mills gets in. Walmart gets in a few years later. Even Coca-Cola buys some organic brands. And you have really the corporatization of organic beginning with that.
And when do you see the emergence of the farmers markets?
Well, they were happening, but there was tremendous growth in farmers markets beginning around 2000, and the number's been going up. I think we're up to 8,000 farmers markets. It went up another 20% last year. Very, very successful category. Very hard to measure. Not everyone's paying their taxes, I think, at the farmer's market. And so we don't have really good statistics.
Nor are they on Wall Street. So.
Well, but they, the size of the local food market is believed now to be about $7 billion, which is
Let's talk about a little bit about the farmer's market from the... from your inside perspective, because it's more than just a booth with some produce.
Oh, it's much more than, it's not just about food. I think what's going on at the farmers market, based on my own observations, is a communitarian movement. I mean, I think that's true of the food movement in general. I think it's as much about community as it is about, the choice of what food you're going to put in your body. I mean, people who go to the farmers markets are doing it for... I mean, I go to the farmers market even if I'm going away and I can't eat anything that I'm going to buy. I mean, I go to just hang out, and there's politics going on at the farmers market. In California, you get a massage at the farmers market. I've never actually done that, but I see it done. There's music being played. There are kids running around. They're just great scenes.
And it's introduced a human scale to the environment where they're located. So contrary to the anxiety of the retailers in the area who were concerned about the competition, it's actually
stimulated it. Yeah, it's brought back neighborhoods. It's had very interesting effects wherever they've been tried. And in general, now you find retailers thrilled to have a farmer's market come in.
And there are, within a commuting radius of the market, there are farms that are kept in active business because they get a
retail price at the farmer's market that
they capture most of the food dollar. And one of the big trends that's happened in the last 30 or 40 years is that your typical food dollar that you spend in the supermarket or a restaurant or, you know, food service, more than 90% goes to someone other than the farmer. And that's one of the reasons farmers have been struggling. In the large food economy, the people who make the packages make more money than the farmers. They make more than 10% of the food dollar. So farmers markets, CSAs, these subscription deals that a lot of people have, is an opportunity for farmers to recapture 90-95% of the food dollar. And that's made an enormous difference in keeping small farms going and also stimulating a renaissance. And there are new people coming into farming. This is the last agricultural census is the first time in American history where from one period to the next, the number of farmers in this country actually went up. It's been going down since we've been measuring it.
Now, I think there are two other things to just throw into that. One is seasonality. So many of us have grown up thinking that strawberry was a 24/7, 365 day a year product, and the other is the education that comes from going to the market, learning about the types of foods, their properties, where they come from.
How to cook with them?
How to cook with
them? You always see people saying, "Now, this kohlrabi, what do you do with this?" And there's a farmer there who'll tell you, or one of your neighbors will tell you.
And the farmers have learned that that's a question that they're going to be getting. So
right.
They've actually done some
recipes.
Research for recipes.
Yeah. Yeah, many of them bring recipes.
Now, meanwhile, all this is going on. You have an explosion of food-related television programming. You have these restaurants that are going out of their way to advertise that they're offering these kinds of foods. And yet, you still have the sense that if you walk into a conventional supermarket, which millions of Americans do every day, that you're taking your life in your hands. the aisles are laced with preservatives and other kinds of chemicals, that dangers that we're not fully apprised of. Everything has some kind of additive or sugar-related sweetener. Everything is sweet. The most bitter things are sweetened. We're addicted to a lot of this stuff. It's obviously playing out in our diets and in our health. Why hasn't there been a more manifest transition there?
Transition?
Well.
Revolt? What do you mean?
Well, cultural shift.
Yeah. I think there's starting to be. I think we've got a long way to go. I mean, I think that the food movement, we use these words, food movement, but it's still very small and marginal and provisional, and that the American diet is, hasn't changed radically yet. There are some signs. There is growth in certain categories of food, and soda consumption is finally down. I mean, all this railing about soda seems to be finally paying off, and parents are starting to realize that as much as their kids might like soda, it's not necessarily good parenting to give your kids a lot of soda. But we've got a long way to go.
I liked your comment earlier this week in an interview with our venerable Marfa Radio. I think you said that they were complimenting you on having a broad influence in this culture, and you said you had a very small influence. The person who had the big influence was the CEO of McDonald's.
Well, I think that you have to realize that people like me and the other people writing this issue, it might seem like we have a big microphone, but the food industry has $42 billion a year to spend in marketing every year. It's a tremendous amount of money, and their message is ubiquitous. Children are getting marketing messages about food all the time, to the extent that parents are losing control of their diet very often, of their kids' diet. So, I still feel like we're nipping around the edges. What happens is you find that the marketing messages about food begin to co-opt the messages that people like me and Marion Nestle are putting out there. And they're really clever. I mean, every time I come up with a formulation to help people navigate the supermarket, they figure out another end run. I mean, they're, give you a couple examples. Don't eat food with more than 5 ingredients. This was a rule in my food rules book. It's not, I, you know, other people have said this, you know, people talking about nutritional food. Well, within a year, you had Tostitos advertising the fact that they only have 3 ingredients in their, you know, their tortilla chips. Congratulations. And then you have Häagen-Dazs introducing an entire brand, a line of ice cream called 5. And you know how many ingredients it had before that? 5. Nothing changed. They just looked down and said, hey, we've got the 5. We've got the mat. We're going to start advertising this. And then this idea of staying out of the middle aisles and shopping around the perimeter, which is now, you hear that meme everywhere. Well, guess what? The processed food is moving into the produce section. Take a look. It starts with that beautifully crafted pomegranate juice that's actually, you know, just because it has the shape of a fruit, they feel that it's entitled to shelf space next to real fruit. You know, this is another sugar delivery system. And although it's supposed to help with erectile dysfunction, according to the health claims.
Like
did
a lot
you,
of other
you know that?
Like a lot of other products in the fruit department. So do you have a sense of the health issues associated with sugar consumption? Is this something that has moved to the front of it?
Sugar is a very big problem. I mean, we're eating on average about 100 and almost 150 pounds per person per year, and there's some people doing double duty, you know, who are drinking a lot of soda. And those numbers are, you know, if you want to know why we have an epidemic of obesity and type 2 diabetes, if you could cut down on the soda alone, it would be under control. There's no single thing we could do as powerful to improve the public health of Americans is to have to regulate soda or have a public health campaign explaining what soda does to people. It's been designed to be addictive. You know, why is there so much sodium and caffeine in soda? Why do you need that to make a sweetened beverage? Well, it makes you thirstier, so you drink more of it. This is the kind of stuff that used to be done to cigarettes. I guess it's still done to some cigarettes. So
are we at the early stage of a comparable public education program that you could envision ending up with the same level?
We're at the stage where the corporations who depend on these products are crushing any efforts to regulate them and are spending a fortune to confuse the science. And so in that sense, we are. But whether we'll proceed to the next stage remains to be seen. There have been soda taxes on the ballots in many places, and every single one has been defeated so far by tremendous spending,
for tens
of millions of dollars. I don't know how much of the cost of a soda now goes to defeating uncomfortable regulations, but a lot. And, you know, Mayor Bloomberg in New York tried to regulate the size of the cups in movie theaters, a power I didn't know the mayor had, actually, I have to say. I don't know if this is a good idea or a bad idea, but we need to try these experiments and see
what works. If you go into these movie theaters, you can't buy less than a gallon of Coke.
No, this could be a soda right there.
It's a $9 purchase, and she says, well, for 25 cents more, you can get twice the amount, 2 gallons or whatever.
Yeah, you feel like a schmuck if you don't do it.
Well, you feel like you're not taking advantage of a good opportunity.
Right. Another way to put it.
But aren't we talking really about, in unadorned language, about a public health epidemic?
There's no question that we have a public health crisis tied to food. And there's no question that the best way, the most beautiful and economical way to reduce the amount of money we're spending on health care in this country would be to reform the American diet. And I'll offer a couple statistics. About 3/4 of healthcare spending goes to treat chronic diseases. okay? We hear some, you know, we hear about overdiagnosis and too many procedures and everything. But what are we diagnosing? What are the procedures for? To treat chronic diseases, most of which, not all, because you have alcoholism and smoking still, but most of which are linked to diet. About a third of the cancers, 80% of the heart disease and stroke, almost all of the type 2 diabetes. The things we're spending the big money on is all linked to diet. And the question is, why aren't we tackling it that way? I mean, we have a system where the food industry is very conveniently creating patients for the healthcare industry. And we need to break that link.
So going back to cigarettes, thinking of that as a kind of a model for some more meaningful public engagement on a profound public health crisis. Something must have driven that. I assume it was cancer.
Well, a couple things drove it. One thing that drove it, I mean, the parallel is complex. It's not easy because no one needs to smoke. Everyone needs to eat. There are many people who eat bad food and have no problem with it. But there are also a lot of parallels. One being, by the way, a lot of the same players. A lot of the tobacco companies got into the food industry when tobacco sales went down. And in fact, when they started being challenged by the food movement, they hired the exact same lobbyists, the exact same PR firms, and they're playing out of the same playbook. Confuse the science, attack the messenger, head it off at the pass. It's a very interesting history, though, because it really was when the costs of treating cancer started to bankrupt the states that the states got very active in suing the tobacco companies to recover those costs. The other thing that helped was that internal documents, it became clear that the tobacco companies knew things that they were lying about.
Right.
So you had that disconnect between what they understood about their products.
That's a parallel.
That is a parallel. But you see, the other side learns from history too. So if there is documentation that shows how to make Coca-Cola more addictive, how to write that formula, that documentation is gone.
Okay.
The files have been cleansed.
So in New York, going back to your Bloomberg example, and I can well appreciate anyone's resistance to using New York as representative of anything, but we'll go for it for the minute.
Unlike Marfa, say.
Marfa, which is broadly representative. In New York, you'll have the most graphic commercials on television discouraging the viewer from smoking that you can imagine. They are, I'm sure you've even seen them, yeah. They are shockingly graphic. They depict people in the terminal stages of life who testify to the adverse effects of smoking. Now, the underpinning of that, the years that it took to reach that place, which enabled a publicly funded agency to have whatever independence and courage was required to put that message out into the public arena without worrying that you would be defeated in the next election, which is usually what you're talking about. And presumably the documentation of the link between smoking and the disease. So those are two things that haven't happened with the adverse impact of bad food. We don't see adequate, at least, I'm sure it exists, but we don't see it in the public sphere, adequate linkage between the consumption of toxic foods and their consequences. And we don't see people in the political arena having the courage to go after these entrenched interests for fear, presumably, of the power of the lobby.
Yeah, well, it's a very powerful lobby. The food lobby is one of the most powerful. It's right up there with oil in terms of the amount of money they spend. You have had some moves toward tougher advertising about food. Bloomberg has also tried that. He's been particularly active for a couple reasons. One is, public health is one of his big issues. He spends a lot of money funding public health initiatives. But also, New York City has a very extensive public hospital system. And they did a study a few years ago and realized that every new case of type 2 diabetes was costing them about $425,000. And that was going to bankrupt that system at the rates it was going up.
Another parallel.
It is another parallel. And so that's why New York is worth watching, because they're on the hook already for health care costs for the poor in a way that few cities are. And that's why they have been so active, and they'll continue to be active. And if they can show results, either with public messaging or taxation or regulation, you will see it sweep across the country. Because you see, what the Obama healthcare law does is it puts the government on the hook a lot more than it has been for many more people's healthcare. And so I actually think you're going to find more support in the government, more support in the health insurance industry, not the healthcare industry necessarily, but health insurance, for tackling the American diet. That they realize that the best way that they can long-term reduce the amount of money they have to spend to keep us healthy will be to reduce things like soda consumption.
Let's just,
so I think that that's a future ally of the food movement.
Let's take up a point that you just alluded to when you're talking about public hospitals, and you mentioned the impact on the poor. Again, with the arrangement of media ownership and the forces that influence the formation of public values in this society, you don't get the same debate over the impact on poor people. But the food issue cuts across these demographic lines ruthlessly. And it's frequently said that organic food, food that is meets the expectations of a more rigorous demand for quality foods, are not affordable across the board, and that whole swaths of the population therefore don't have the opportunity. Where does that part of the discussion fit in this debate?
It's a critically important part, and the food movement is often accused of being elitist, and there is some truth to that accusation. And there's a couple responses to it, but we've managed to make food very cheap in America. We spend less on food than any people in any other country, any people who have ever lived. It's, I think, 9.5%, 9.5% of income. Of the individual's income is spent on food. When I was a boy, like 1960, it was 18%. 1910, it was 24%. Okay, we've driven it down. It's an incredible achievement in many, many ways. The problem is that the way we did it led to a diminishing in its quality, because that's processed food that's the cheapest. But the point is that cheap food is now baked into the way the economy works. It is the reason, I think, that family wages have fallen in America since the 70s. People could put up with this because the price of food kept getting cheaper. So cheap food has subsidized falling wages in this country.
As a proportion of their expenditures.
Exactly. So how do you now turn around and say, we really have to pay the real cost of food? We can no longer externalize the environmental damage that cheap food is involved with. We can no longer externalize the health effects. Well, you've got people now dependent on cheap food. Finally, we're going to have to pay people enough money to be able to afford the real price of food. There are things we can do to democratize organic food and democratize local food. We can look at the incentives nationally, because right now, if you look at the Farm Bill, which is really the set of rules that govern the whole system, it's designed in such a way that the cheapest calories in the supermarket are the least healthy. Soda is cheaper than milk. Twinkies are cheaper than, salad greens. And that's a policy choice that we could redo, and we need to redo. But finally, you're going to need to deal with it at a societal level. You need to pay people a living wage. You need to look at the minimum wage if you're going to address the food issue.
So obviously there's a number of different paths we can continue to go down in relation to the specifics about the food system and the problems we face in trying to reform it. The theme of our program this weekend has been the relationship of these various topics to climate change.
And I've been wondering why I'm here. Just kidding.
Part of, well, it's a long way back to El Paso on foot. Part of our program this weekend includes a tour tomorrow morning of the Mims Ranch, where some of the strategies for carbon reduction that you've outlined in your writing have been adopted. So can we shift a little bit over into describing the relationship of the food system as it exists to the issues that we're starting to define in relation to climate change?
Yeah. Well, when I started working on the impacts of the way we feed ourselves in agriculture, I was struck by how deeply implicated the food system is in the climate problem. And, you know, the estimates are all over the place, but somewhere between 20 and 33% of greenhouse gases can be traced to the way we feed ourselves. That includes everything from the methane produced by animals on feedlots and elsewhere, to the nitrous oxide released by fertilizers, to the fuel required to make conventional fertilizers, to the processing itself, to the moving around of food around the world. I mean, you know, a lot of us don't realize how much carbon's embedded in our food. You might go to the store and be lucky enough to find sustainable salmon from Alaska, which is one of the better seafood choices you can make. But the chances are good that that salmon, after it was caught, was flown to China to be filleted and then returned here. And so, you know, how green is that choice? There is a lot of carbon in our food and a lot of energy taken to produce it.
Perhaps it's related to the Governor Palin's ability to see China from Alaska.
I think that was Russia, but they are close. Yeah, they're very close. One of the biggest changes in our food system pre-World War II to today has to do with the amount of fossil fuel that it takes to produce food. You go back before World War II, and for every calorie of fossil fuel energy, remember, a calorie is just a unit of energy, right? You can measure calories in your food, calories in your gas tank, anything. For every calorie of fossil fuel put into the food system to grow your food in the form of diesel for your tractors or your combines, you got out 2 calories of food energy. Okay, so you had a net gain of a calorie. Where did that come from? The sun, solar energy. Astonishing. That's the free lunch, right? It's that extra calorie. Well, the average calorie today of food you buy in the supermarket takes 10 calories of fossil fuel energy to produce 1 calorie of food energy. I'm sorry, 10 calories of fossil fuel to produce 1 calorie of food energy. And if you're eating beef, feedlot beef, it's 55 calories. So one of the big challenges, and this has to do with our energy use as well as climate change, is figuring out ways to move the food system back, and I use the word back advisedly because actually it's going to take a moving forward, but back onto the sun. Because food, unlike so many other things, is about solar energy at its very core, right? Every calorie you've ever eaten, finally, is photosynthesis or now oil. But we can make food from the sun. We know how to do that. And we can sequester carbon that way, too. So one of the things I spent a lot of time looking at was ranching and how we grow beef in this country. And I spent time on feedlots. And I spent time on sustainable ranches. And the thing, I mean, just to turn a little more positive for a second, the most uplifting thing I saw in all my years of looking at food came when I was on Joel Salatin's farm. He's been really one of the visionary leaders in figuring out ways to re-solarize. And he has this farm in Virginia, in the Shenandoah Valley, and he grows 6 different animal species in a very elaborate rotation so that each one of them is performing some ecological function for another one. and the chickens live on the maggots in the cow manure. That's their favorite food, and they take care of his fly problem. It's a brilliant system. Everything's constantly moving. He moves his cattle every single day, his chickens every single day. And it really works. He gets a lot of food off of 100 acres of land. But the thing I want to focus on is when I got there, Joel said to me, I wanted to meet the animals. I really like animals. I had a pet pig when I was a kid, and I couldn't wait to see the animals. And he said, no, before you meet the animals, you have to meet the grass. I said, the grass? Okay. Because I said, what kind of farmer are you? And he said, I'm a grass farmer, which sounded weird to me because we don't eat grass. We can't eat grass. We're not ruminants. And so he made me get down on my belly, and we like looked at a square foot of grass. And he told me all the different species and showed me the worm castings. And he explained what happens when a ruminant grazes grass. And it's quite a miraculous thing. And it completely changed my understanding of our relationship to nature, which I think, like most of us, I conceived of nature as the human nature relationship as a zero-sum relationship, so that there's this pie, and either we're getting more or nature's getting more, and that when we get what we need from nature, whether it's food or energy or entertainment, nature's diminished in some way. That's what I thought. I thought that was our tragic lot. But when he explained what happens under the ground on a pasture, I had to rethink that. So here's what happens, and some of you may know this, but let's say you've got a pasture of tall grass, and maybe it's 2 or 3 feet tall, and you bring your cattle in, and your cattle give it a close shave, and the grass plants are all down to 2 inches, say. What happened underneath? Well, grass, like most plants, like to keep its root mass and its leaf mass in a rough balance. So if you cut 2 feet, or almost 2 feet, of leaf mass, the plant is going to kill off a comparable amount of root mass, and it has that much. And what happens to those roots? They are broken down by the earthworms, by the nematodes, by the bacteria, by the fungi. They're digested by the soil and turned into what? Nitrogen and carbon sequestered. And this pulsing of pastures, animals shaving grasslands, grasslands regrowing, is how soil's created. And the potential for sequestering carbon with well-managed grasslands is extraordinary. And you know, there's this history of tension, obviously, between ranchers and environmentalists. This understanding has the power to break that. And I think that there is enormous potential. Now, there are a lot of implications. You're going to have to eat beef. Someone's going to have to eat beef. But a lot less of it, because you can't produce as much beef this way. However, the beef you will produce will be not just better for the grassland, not just better for the environment, but it'll be better for you too.
Now, earlier this afternoon, we had a really very provocative and compelling panel. Two very distinguished scientists, John Nielsen Gammon, and I think I have his name correctly, and Diana Liverman. Both climatologists. He's, I think, the state climatologist in Texas. She has an institute in Arizona. They agreed from different perspectives, but they arrived at the same place that we have reached a 400 parts per million at the measurement of carbon, which is past the maximum that was forecast by a lot for this date. They agreed that this is a result unequivocally of human contributions. They also said that as the temperatures have moved radically upward in the Southwest, that agriculture has been forced to adapt, and that they are in, that agriculture is now involved in the exploration of the means by which they can continue to farm, to raise beef, to raise crops under these new environmental conditions. So even as there may be some historic tension between the two camps, reality is forcing them together, I think.
Possibly. you know, there are two trends going on. The other is, though, the government, with its latest farm bill, wants to insure farmers for doing any crazy thing. And you know, that would not drive any kind of change. Basically, you know, they want to offer crop insurance so that wherever you plant, even if there's drought 8 years out of 10, we'll pick up the tab. And that's going to discourage the kind of adaptation we need. But yeah, there are a lot of, you know, there's a generation of visionary farmers out there trying to solve these problems. And, you know, we talk about geoengineering. We're starting to have that conversation. It's very interesting. We went right from no problem with climate change to maybe we should do something to reduce carbon to no, we can't do that. Let's engineer our way out of it. You know, I think that's a necessary conversation. It's kind of tragic, but it's a necessary conversation. But we need to realize, and I was having this conversation with Tom Rand yesterday, that we are already geoengineering all the cropland in the world. We've been doing it for a very long time. We know a lot about how to do it in good ways and bad ways. And that there is no reason we can't create incentives for farmers to make sequestering carbon central to their work, central to what we as a society subsidize them to do. We could change our subsidies so it's not for every bushel of grass of corn you can grow, but it's for every unit of carbon you can sequester. And that would lead to a more diverse food system because you have to diversify, and it would lead to more perennial food systems.
So you allude to the presence of the political process. One doesn't get the sense that the political classes have made climate change not just central to their policymaking, but even marginal to their policymaking.
Oh, we're going backwards. Backwards.
I was very struck. I mean, I think this is both parties, by the way, but I was very struck. I read the 2008 Republican platform 4 years ago. Called for technology-driven, market-based solutions that will decrease emissions, reduce excess greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, increase energy efficiency, mitigate the impact of climate change where it occurs, and maximize any ancillary benefits climate change might offer for the economy. Now, that was Republicans 4 years ago. 4 years later, Romney takes the accepts the nomination, and he mocks Obama openly on national television for elevating climate change to the level of a severe threat in our national security protocols. And he ended it by saying, Obama promised to slow the rise of the oceans, and he pauses for audience laughter, and to heal the planet, as if these were contemptible initiatives. My promise is to help you and your family. So they have moved. They were in pretty good position on this 4 years ago, and have moved to a point where it's 180 degrees in the opposite direction. Meanwhile, Diana Liverman is explaining to us that we're headed for permanent structural drought in the American Southwest, where the water on the surface is dried up completely, and the municipalities are having to rely on groundwater and agriculture as well. And I don't detect a great deal of difference in the Democratic Party in terms of prioritization.
No, Obama stopped talking about it, and you're not going to hear him talk about it. I'll give you a dollar for I'll give everyone in the room a dollar for every time Obama mentions climate change in this election.
Can we have some witnesses?
In fact, he's not even allowing his cabinet to talk about climate change. Vilsack, Secretary of Agriculture, spent a lot of time in the Midwest during the drought. And every stop, the reporter said, doesn't climate change have something to do with this? And he had a line that had obviously been written for him, which was, I'm not a scientist. I am not a scientist. I am not a scientist. He said it like six times. They're not going to talk about it. And that's I find that incredibly
discouraging.
Could they possibly do something about it after they're reelected, assuming they are?
Is it election-driven, though, or is this a deeper malaise?
They think it's a losing issue. I don't know. I mean, we were close, you know. I mean, there was a climate bill that got pretty close And then came 2010, and you know, was it, should it have been a higher priority or not for Obama? I don't know. I mean, he did run on the issue partly last time. He will not this time, as far as I can see.
Now, the mainstream media doesn't really make much of a difference. They treated Romney's remark as a clever joke and applauded it in that sort of sycophantic way. But we're not getting a independent, objective account of the realities of our situation from the source of information that the majority of people rely on the most. Where's the bright spot in this picture?
I don't know. It's a very discouraging time for this issue. I think it will come back. I don't know what it will take to bring it back. You know, it may be some disaster. But I think it's untenable. I mean, I just can't believe that we will decide as this generation that now we're not going to do anything about this. Right now, that's where we are. I mean, I think it's a really tough issue for people to get their head around. I think we're all climate deniers at the deepest level. It's very hard to believe. It's very hard to accept.
Too abstract?
It's abstract, but the implications of believing it are a lot to take. And, you know, I think that we're just kind of wired not to take in this kind of information and reject it as long as we possibly can.
Sir, is there a sense of impotence about what individuals can do about it?
I mean, I think some of it has to do with the way our lives are organized. I mean, you know, we're so dependent on fossil fuel. I mean, this is something Wendell Berry's been telling us since the 70s. You know, he defines our problem with regard to all environmental issues, and this is before we knew what climate change was, that there is something called the cheap energy mind, and we all have cheap energy minds. And, you know, we're so specialized. We do one thing. We do one thing at work, and we get paid for that, by and large. And that's our production, and everything else is consumption. And that we depend on other people to heat our houses and to grow our food and to entertain us and inform us. And we do very little on our own, because fossil fuel allows us to outsource everything to very distant other people. And so that's one of the reasons, and this was talked about, and Rebecca talked about it earlier today, the importance of doing things like putting in a victory garden, is that it gives you a sense of, well, maybe I could take care of myself and my family and begin to imagine a different world, a different way of taking care of yourself, a less dependent on fossil fuel way of living. Those things begin, I think, with small steps of despecializing ourselves, learning to do more for ourselves. And I think that's really, really important. So that's a baby step, but I think it's a really important one. Until we feel a little more competent, omnicompetent, it's going to be hard to imagine a world with much less fossil fuel in it.
It's a big room, and I think there are a lot of people who would like the opportunity to have a conversation with Michael. We're going to take some questions, and I want to just emphasize the word question. We get to make the speeches, so please, if you want to come down to these microphones. And before you do, I'd just like to dispel a certain controversy that emerged earlier, which is why is Michael Pollan invited to a occasion where there's a dialogue between artists and other people who have expertise in the subject. And I think it's important just to, in an uncharacteristic way, to defend your honor, that he's married to a great artist, Judith Belzer, who's with us tonight, came all the way from San Francisco, and at that sort of dicey moment when you were on the edge of having to walk back to El Paso, she was probably going to be having to walk with you. And the other thing I'd add is that you've produced this exquisite book, which is an illustrated version of your Food Rules book, which I think qualifies you, if not as an artist, at least to communicate with artists. So thank you very much to Michael for his comments. And let me throw it open to the floor. I'd like to invite people to get up to the microphone. Do we have a question over here?
Yes, I do.
Please.
John Johnson, I live in Marfa, and a group of us, small group of us in Marfa, are talking about creating a growers and canning co-op. Okay, it's to stimulate and encourage gardening locally, because we don't have any farms here other than the tomato farms. We have a lot of ranching, but not a lot of farming. So then the question comes, is our money better spent investing in canning processes or other food preservation processes, or is it better spent in building greenhouses so that we can grow through the winter?
Well, that's a tough one. I don't think I'm qualified to offer advice on agronomy in a particular region. I think the local food movement is discovering the importance of canning and fermenting and preservation. I think it's a really, really important part of the puzzle. I mean, you know, if you're going to make local food a 12-month proposition, you've got to figure out ways to preserve it. And so I think that is a very important movement. But whether this is a good place for greenhouse agriculture, which I think there is a place for, you certainly have enough sunlight, as far as I can tell. But it would be glib of me, I think, to offer that kind of advice.
I think there is also a worth consideration, a emphasis on seasonal growing and overwintering, which has been done in Marfa and is a plausible response to that.
Yeah.
Over here.
Yes. Where do you see the urban farming movement headed in the next 10 years for highly populated cities?
The urban farming movement is one of the most exciting. When we talk about the food movement, it's not like it's a monolith. It's a lot of little movements that are mostly under one big umbrella. But the urban farming movement is one of the most exciting things going on right now. I visited some of these farms, including a really impressive one in Milwaukee that Will Allen is running, close to the biggest public housing development there. And he's showing how much food you can grow on 2 or 3 urban acres, under glass, by the way, how many jobs you can create. He's employing 50 or 60 people in well-paying jobs, and how many people you can feed. This goes back to that access question of how do you democratize the food movement. And urban agriculture in underserved areas is a really important way to do it. And he's doing some of the similar kind of permaculture, as they're called, systems, where you're combining, say, fish and produce. And he has a similar system to Joel's, where he grows golden perch and tilapia in these greenhouses. And you're thinking, oh, this must, in Milwaukee, that's fossil fuel intensive. But in fact, he heats his greenhouse with compost. He takes in city waste. He kind of hypercharges these compost piles with worms. His passion is worms, the way Joel's is grass.
Are you familiar with John Todd?
Yeah, he's a permaculture visionary.
Eco-machines and stuff.
And so what he does is, so the fish dirty the water, and it's full of nitrogen, and they pump that water out, and then they have a bed of gravel hanging over the tank in which they planted greens and other vegetables. And the dirty water passes through that gravel bed, and along the way, the plants take all the nutrients they need, clean the water, and then it can be fed back into the tanks as clean water for the fish. So it's a closed system, very little fossil fuel, produces lots of really high quality protein, and employs a lot of people. So I think it's got great potential. I think we've got a lot of, in Detroit too is another place where you've got a lot of empty land.
Integration into school districts and stuff as well.
Yeah, and making links with schools is a very important part. You know, it's very interesting, historically, our goal with farming was to make farmers more productive, so we could have fewer farmers. And this was deliberate government policy: shrink the number of farmers for a lot of reasons. We wanted people to work in factories. This is post World War II, but also farmers were politically really troublesome in the Progressive Era. You know, there's a tradition of very progressive farmers that join caused with the labor movement and created all sorts of problems for the government. So the government set out to shrink the number of farmers. Now we need more farmers, and we've got high unemployment. And so urban agriculture, I think, is one part of that solution. Thanks for bringing it up.
Appreciate it.
Hi, I work for the food bank here. And my question is about food deserts in the media. There's a lot of stories and articles about the food desert problems in urban areas, but I find very little traction on trying to get people to talk about them
in the real desert.
In the real desert. And also where people, I don't know if it's because there's not enough people here, or I wondered from your journalistic experience or your perspective, how to talk more about the food desert in rural impoverished areas.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, the food desert concept, which is basically the idea that many poor people live in places where they don't have access to fresh produce, I actually think has been a bit of a hype. I mean, the current research suggests it's a little more complicated than that, that there is often more fast food than supermarket food, but there are supermarkets that people have access to. The problem is there's good and bad food in a supermarket. So the idea, and I know Michelle Obama has pushed this idea pretty hard, that if we just simply make produce available to people, poor people, that they will avail themselves of it. It's more complicated than that. I mean, there are many people who no longer have either the time or the skills to cook fresh produce. And if you're going to get fresh produce aside from lettuce, you need to do something with it. So it's a larger cultural issue of you know, being out of the habit of cooking, knowing what to do with raw food, being and food banks are, you know, can be part of the problem because for various reasons having to do with economics and practicality, they tend to have more packaged food than fresh food.
That's true.
And so one of the interesting movements going on around the country is getting more fresh food into food banks and getting supermarkets who throw out literally tons of high-quality fresh food every day to move that into food banks. So you can at least give people the opportunity to work with fresh food. You know, in general, yeah, the media tends to pay attention to, I mean, this isn't just about food banks, but they tend to pay attention to urban problems because that's where they think, you know, their readership is or their viewership. But good luck with your work. It's really important work.
Thanks.
Right now. And finding, you know, making, forging relationships with supermarkets and restaurants.
We do.
That's great. That's really, really important.
Thanks. Hi. How would you characterize the agricultural relationship between the United States and Mexico? And how important is that, for better or for worse, in terms of the larger story you tell about food in the United States?
That's a good one. Every now and then you get a question you've never heard before.
You have to come down close to the Mexican border to.
Yeah, I know. I know. I wonder why. Yeah. You know, NAFTA has been a disaster in many ways in Mexico. It has led to the industrialization of Mexican agriculture. And over time, the best land in Mexico has been rededicated to feeding us. And I think that that's been an enormous problem. It's thrown a lot of people off the land in Mexico and driven them into urban ghettos. And it has moved money to Mexico, but if you look at the farmers who are benefiting, they're often American farmers who've set up shop there to produce more cheaply. It's not that different than a lot of other products that are in this trade. I'm not against trade in food when it's done on the right terms. I don't think we're going to move to a completely localized food economy. I don't think we've had that for 1,000 years. And it isn't necessarily the goal. Although I do think it's very important that we feed ourselves to the extent we can. I mean, Marfa can't feed itself. I mean, there are many places that can't feed itself. But that there be some local capability is really important. In Mexico, which is the birthplace of corn, to have that peasant agriculture, which is husbanding these genetic resources, the ancestors of corn, to have them switching over to GM corn and modern hybrid corn in these vast monocultures, I think is going to come back to bite us because modern corn varieties will fail eventually. And where last time this happened in 1970, we had a corn blight and we lost 10 or 20% of the crop 1 year because of a disease, because there's such a narrow genetic base to all the corn we plant. We went back to southern Mexico, I think to Chiapas, and we found the genes we needed in traditional corn varieties to save corn. And we're losing those, that land. So there may be more positives that I don't know about on the Mexican side, but in general, I don't think it has been a boon, and I think it will hurt not only Mexican farmers, but us eventually.
Is food safety an issue that is covered in that?
It should be. Food safety is a big problem. A lot of imported food does not get inspected. I mean, the whole nature of food safety has changed with globalization, but also with the way we produce food on such a mass scale. You know, when you have one bagged lettuce company in the Salinas Valley making 25 million servings, washing 25 million servings of lettuce, even if it's domestic American lettuce, if you get a contaminant in that sink, all the lettuce that's gone through that sink is a problem. So one of the virtues of a localized food system is it's more resilient. You localize problems also. And we're globalizing problems with the way we're feeding ourselves right now.
My question is kind of contradicting something you just said, in that about 60 or 70 years ago, before the interstate highway system and a lot of the growth of commercial agriculture, this area did pretty much produce and process the food that was eaten here. I wasn't here then, but this is what I hear. And a prime example of how bad it's gotten, we have tons of goats being grown in the area, but if you go to the supermarket and want to buy goat meat, it's from New Zealand because of federal or state regulations that prevent the goat growers from selling the meat.
Well, that's a great case, actually. I mean, one of the problems with, and one of the virtues of localizing a food system is you figure out what you can grow where you are. And that's traditionally what people would do, and they trade it for other things that they couldn't grow. And, you know, in a landscape like this, goats are, you know, who can eat anything and don't need a lot of water, are one way to turn solar energy into food. Cattle, too. And there is a lot of interest in a local meat economy. People would like to eat local meat. One of the great impediments to the rise, to the renaissance of local meat economy, which is happening all over the country right now, is the fact we don't have slaughter facilities. Mm-hmm. And the government has tended to consolidate those facilities, and you can understand their logic. You know, if you send a meat inspector to a Cargill plant, he or she can look at, you know, 50,000 head in a day and process a lot of meat. Where if you send them to a small custom plant around here, they're going to look at a couple carcasses a day. So how do you justify this? Well, you have to justify it on grounds other than that narrow definition of efficiency. But the fact is that if we would support new local slaughterhouses, that would in turn make it possible for more local meat production. Because that's the problem. I mean, if you talk to local ranchers, they'll say, I've got to go 300 miles to get my meat processed. And that's another reason.
Is that in that statistic that you gave earlier about the calories that are
That's part of
created?
It. That's definitely part of it, how far they go. But that's another reason that local meat is so expensive. Mm-hmm. Because Cargill, you know, there are four meat packers now that slaughter 85 to 90% of the beef. Just four companies. They can do it very efficiently. I mean, in these brutal, you know, slaughterhouses, but they can do it very efficiently. So it only costs them $40 to $50 to take a steer and get it wrapped into steaks. Okay? They can do that whole process for a whole animal, slaughter it. And you do that in a local slaughterhouse and it's $300 or $400. So that's a lot of what you're paying. And if we could make it easier on local meat farmers you would see a lot more people doing it.
And they teach that in Sol Ross here in Alpine, or 20 miles away. And we had a meat processing plant here 20 years ago when I moved here, but it's now a storage unit.
You know, a lot of them have gone out of business, too, because the federal regulations, there was a generation just said, I don't want to deal with this, and they retired. And but now there are mobile slaughterhouses coming back. The USDA does have some very positive programs in this area, and that's one of the things to fight for.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks for your question.
We have Professor Marson from Geography and Development Department at the University of Arizona.
Thank you very much.
How'd you know all that?
You'll find out in a minute.
I'm quite interested in other sites for possible solutions to the problem, and I wonder if you've spent any time thinking about land-grant institutions where ag colleges or ag departments are prominent. I ask this because I myself run a small school garden internship at the University of Arizona, and I know nothing about agriculture. I do it for social justice reasons, and my experience with gardening is fairly limited, although I have my own. But I noticed that increasingly ag students come over to my program, and even my colleagues in the ag department say, we're running out of students, and we're being pressured more and more to have a different kind of agricultural model that we're teaching. So I don't know what your experience is. I think at Berkeley, it's not an ag college.
Technically, it is a land grant, but they moved most of that out to Davis.
To Davis.
Yeah.
So I wonder what your own experience is with that as a site for potential transformation.
Yeah.
If we change our institutions at the regional level or even at the state level, is that the place where we can make the biggest changes? Because it seems to me that change comes at the local level and not at the federal level anyway.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I think the land-grant universities have a tremendous role to play. But right now they're fighting a rearguard action. And the reason is that the land-grant universities, these were set up, every state has at least one, but usually a couple, that they have federal money and they work on training farmers and developing agricultural technology. It goes back to Lincoln. And it had a lot to do with developing agriculture in America. The problem is, in the last couple decades, they've been sort of captured by the agribusiness corporations. And my experience, what happened at Lubbock has happened at several different land grants, mm-hmm. where I've been invited to talk because there's a lot of interest in the part of the students and always a couple faculty members in, let's look at sustainable agriculture. Let's look at organic. Because this is the only part of the food market that's growing. Okay? The only part of the food market that's growing is local, sustainable, and organic. And so, you know, they're smart and they want to get in on it. But what inevitably happens is that funders of the land grants, which are now private more than the government, stop it. There was a case in California. We have a notorious feedlot called the Harris Ranch on Route 5 in Coalinga. It's called Cowschwitz in the neighborhood. And I was invited to speak at Cal Poly, California Polytechnic Institute, and they wanted to have a big discussion about sustainable agriculture. And the head of Mr. Harris wrote the president and said, we're going to remove $500,000 in funding if Mr. Pollan's allowed to speak unchallenged. And this got in the papers and was very embarrassing to the university. And they basically turned what was supposed to be a speech into a debate. And I had to debate some old-timers from their animal science program, which was fine. I mean, there's nothing wrong with debating these issues. But I think we need to open up a conversation in the land grants mm-hmm. because this kind of, you know, the kind of farming I was describing, this has been invented by farmers working on their own with no help from anyone. Imagine if we put a little research and development into developing new rotations for animal agriculture, new rotations for plant agriculture. Mm-hmm. When you think how much is, and most of organic, you know, was invented by organic farmers. So there is enormous potential, and that's where it should come. And there is gradually starting to be some interest. There's a lot of sustainable agriculture at Davis now. Berkeley is about to start to take back a little bit of that that turf. There's a Berkeley Sustainable Food Institute just about I don't think I'm supposed to announce this yet.
we won't tell anyone.
Isn't this on the radio?
Your secret is safe.
Well, this might be happening. That will, and a lot of people in the Environmental College of Natural Resources working on diversified farming systems and how to make them work and finding out how much soil, how much carbon can be captured in Western grasslands. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, there are people who want to fund this kind of thing. So I'm hopeful, but it's going to be, that's where the fight is going to be.
I think so, too. Thanks.
Thank you.
I was curious as to what you thought of lab-grown meat. It's not something available on the market right now, obviously, but maybe in the future it would it would take a lot less energy to produce, take a lot less fossil fuels.
Do people know what lab-grown meat is?
No.
Okay, it's the idea that you could kill one steer and then stop killing steer because you would start cloning. The meat instead of having to kill any more animals. And this is there has been research. There's a guy in Denmark or Sweden who claims he's figured out how to do it. I think it's a thought experiment. It's an interesting thought experiment. I don't think we're ever going to be eating lab-grown meat. For one thing, they're not going to get past, prediction, but meat is not just muscle cells. Okay, it's got a lot of other stuff in it. It's got fat, it's got sinews, it's, you know, everything that makes meat wonderful is, you know, it's not a single kind of cell. So you need to grow all the different kind of cells and you need to put them in the right arrangements. And by the way, what are you going to feed those cells? I mean, it may take more fossil fuel than you think. Right now they're doing, you have to give them fetal serum from, you know, that's what you have to feed them on. So you have to kill a lot of cows to feed them. I don't take it that seriously. I know that people who
the Paris Exposition of 1888, the critics panned the electric light bulb.
Yeah, I know. That's right. I might be on the wrong side of history here. I think they might come up with a vat-grown hot dog. Okay, you know, a hot dog is already a kind of mush of, you know, who knows what, and. You know, but I think the tofu hot dogs are, you know, almost there. So why bother?
Well, on this, thank you for your question. On this subject of science, though, the future is now. Genetic modification is upon us. It's part of industrial farming. You're involved in a battle in California as we speak.
Yeah, we've got an interesting proposition on the ballot in California. You know, we have this crazy way of making law in California where you get a couple hundred thousand people. And that's a charitable way to put it. But on balance, I don't know that it's going to boon to democracy. But there's a ballot initiative that would require the labeling of genetically modified food. I think this is a fight worth watching because it's going to affect what happens in Texas. It's going to affect what happens across the country. Basically, 80 to 90% of the public wants the choice whether to eat genetically modified food or not. This is something the industry has very much not wanted you to have, which is odd considering how, you know, they boast about that these technologies are so wonderful and they're going to feed the world and they're going to solve all our problems. Still, they like to be loud about it over here and super quiet about it over here. They have managed to defeat legislation to require labeling of genetically modified food in the U.S. Congress, in state legislatures all over the country. This is the first time that citizens are going to have a chance to weigh in on this. The industry is going to spend about $40 million to prevent this. Now, whatever you think about genetically modified food, it seems to me a pretty good ground to argue on that you should have a choice. I mean, there's so much information already on that food package. So why not? Why not let people decide on their own? Well, I think they're afraid a lot of people decide not to eat it. And they'll have to relabel all this food. And, you know, it will basically erode Monsanto's hold on the seed market, which is now enormous. Because there'll be a tremendous demand for non-GM seed. So I think it's going to be a really interesting fight. I think it's really important for the food movement that they win this one. They haven't had a victory like this, and I think it will strengthen their hand in Washington. Obama's attitude toward the food movement has been, since the beginning, show me the movement. I don't see anything here. And therefore, he has not moved. And the industry, the organic industry, has found itself in negotiations with Obama's agricultural department and has not gotten anywhere. And Monsanto has won every one of those negotiations. This will change. This will strengthen their hand. So I think it's worth watching. I think it could change things.
Yes, I wanted to ask about the fight against the big companies that are advertising to the children. I always had this idea that maybe our problem was a loss of family unit, that rather than we're fighting the symptom basically by going to these companies and trying to quiet it when we should be focusing at home in really teaching and learning. But I just wondered your take on that, or if there's a movement out there for that, because I mean, they have all the money in the world to keep telling us whatever we need to hear.
Yeah.
And is there more, are we going to get at the root cause, or is there?
Well, I think that's a great question. I mean, the Obama administration, this is a great example of the Obama administration kind of ducking some of these issues. They decided the tack to take was to get the industry to have a voluntary set of guidelines for marketing to children, a voluntary set. And they would negotiate this with the industry and, people in the food movement, and they'd work something out, and it would be tepid and make everybody happy. The industry wouldn't even concede to negotiating a voluntary set of guidelines. that would be a slippery slope, and therefore there should be no guidelines of any kind. And Obama caved. And so we're nowhere on that right now. It's really important. The industry's response to any efforts to change the food system is that, hey, this is what people want to eat. Individual choice, free choice, personal responsibility.
First Amendment.
Exactly, First Amendment.
And I just parenthetically would insert that any policymaker who feels the chill of a potentially adverse outcome in the Supreme Court on those grounds has a reason to be worried about it. I mean, I could see why even somebody felt strongly about the issue would go cautiously into it.
And they would, and they should, because we're now getting challenges to the FDA. To its credit, has been cracking down on bogus health claims, and they went after. Remember, I was talking about the pomegranate juice that helps with erectile dysfunction. It's also supposed to, help with heart disease and stroke. I mean, everything that ails you, and so they went to the Palm Corporation, which is owned by a very powerful interest in California, and said, "You can't say that anymore." And the Palm Corporation is suing on First Amendment grounds to say whatever the hell they want about their pomegranate juice. And under the precedents that we now have, we'll see how that plays out. So that's going to make it very hard to change marketing to children.
I mean, this First Amendment has been undergoing an incredible stretch. Bush, for a long time, when he wanted to control the media, had a First Amendment pen. And reporters were permitted to stand in the First Amendment pen, even if it were a mile and a half from the site that they were trying to cover. And you were talking earlier about Bloomberg. The opposition to the proposed ban on 2-gallon containers of soda is based on this miraculous First Amendment and the right of alleged right of the consumer to choose to consume 2 gallons of sugar.
But it's also based on this idea of personal responsibility, which doesn't apply to children. The reason, we don't. The idea is kids need help making decisions.
There's
the idea
a precedent,
is that
though.
Parents make decisions for kids.
There is a precedent.
Paternalism is fine. And we invented the term for children. And so the infiltration of corporate messages into the space between parents and kids is a horrible thing. And parents need help resisting it. But of course, parents, you know, there are other ways parents can resist it.
Mm-hmm. Speaking about Coke and sugar, kind of coming off of this question, I was dismayed to find out that you can buy candy and Cokes on food stamps, and have often wondered what the politics were behind that, and was wondering if you might shed some light on that.
Yeah, well, it is true. I waded into this debate. I published something where I said we should really re-examine this, the idea that you can use your food stamps, now called SNAP payments, to buy candy and Coca-Cola and soda, because I didn't realize that was true. But you will get enormous amount of pushback, and not just from the soda industry. What is called, in a rather ugly term, the hunger lobby in Washington will fight tooth and nail not to have any restrictions, because they see that as a slippery slope, and that if the rich can buy soda, why shouldn't the poor be able to buy soda? I have a lot of trouble with that argument. I think that we already tell people on food stamps you can't buy alcohol on food stamps. Now, arguably, there's more nutritional value in a glass of red wine than there is in a Coca-Cola. So we're already making some moral determinations about this. And it is public money. And, it's something to debate. But I think it's something we should consider. We already have other aid programs, WIC. This is a program for women with children that is organized around supposedly more nutritious food, that you can only use it for milk and eggs and produce. You can't use it for soda and things like that. I think it's a debate we need to have. I mean, I basically think it's ridiculous that we be on, Tom Friedman's always talking about we're supporting both sides in the war on terror. We're supporting the Saudis but we're supporting both sides in the war on type 2 diabetes.
But I think you've touched for over an hour repeatedly on intersections in American life where a social reality has some connection to government. And without exception, there is the sense that the powerful interest prevails in the public arena. I mean, there's always going to be a local representative who slips some crazy little provision into some omnibus bill that gets their constituent, if it's Coke on food stamps. I mean, that's not a small constituent, but it does seem that pattern.
No, and
prevails.
Coca-Cola does fund the hunger lobby, by
sure.
the way, and all the food companies do, and that's one of the reasons. But I am more hopeful than that. I think that there is pressure building for change, and the rise of the local food economies is an attempt to address that very problem. People are impatient. They don't want to wait for the U.S. Congress to get it on food, and they don't have to wait. And one of the most powerful things about this movement is the fact that everybody can do something today. We get 3 votes a day.
But those are educated people. Those are affluent people. Poor people need protection.
They do, and that's right. And that's why the fight has to be fought in Washington as well as in Marfa and Berkeley and all the places where we live. But the fact is that we're not helpless before all this corporate money. And that decision, voting with our fork is never going to be adequate, but it's going to be important. We need to vote with our votes as well. But one will follow from the other, I think.
Last question.
Thank you. Thank you for coming out tonight. My question is that when I was a child, the anti-smoking education that took place within the schools was very powerful for me, in part because my father was a smoker, and I would go home and just beg my dad to stop smoking. So it didn't really affect me in the sense that I wanted to. I didn't want to smoke later on when I was older. It's that I had great love for my dad and great love for my family, and that's what caused me to not want to smoke ever. Can something like that take place within the school system with use of soda, for instance?
Yes. I mean, the simple answer is yes. And some of the most hopeful things going on in this area have to do with what's happening in the schools, with school gardens, school cooking programs. The Edible Schoolyard, Alice Waters program, which she started in Berkeley, is now going viral around the country. And these are programs to teach kids about food. And learning how to deal with food, which is to say how to grow it, how to cook it, how to eat it, is one of the most important life skills we can teach our kids. And it's this next generation that's in school now is where the change is going to happen. It's very hard to change people's dietary profile, the way they eat late in life. It's a very hard set of habits to change. But they're formed when they're in elementary school. So there are a lot of programs like this. We need more funding for those programs, and it's up against enormous pressures to, you know, focus on academic subjects. Now, food is an academic subject, but it's also a sensory subject. Kids love learning about food. They love learning how to cook. And if there was any one place we should put our resources, that would be it.
Kindergarten.
Kindergarten, right.
This morning, we had a chance to visit Marfa's own farm stand, Marfa, to get a sense of the all the communitarian and other values you've been
fantastic.
Talking about.
And it was the first farmer's market I've ever been to that sold rocks, which you have a lot of around here.
But there were no recipes. That's because we're emphasizing local and seasonal.
Right.
All right, well, it's been a great pleasure, Michael, to have you come to Marfa. It's been a terrific evening. The last couple of days have been great, and we look forward to seeing more of you tomorrow. Thanks to everybody for showing up tonight. This great book and a number of others are out for sale in the lobby at Marfa Book Company. Michael, I know, would be happy to contribute an affectionate remark and a signature to any copy that you buy, and there are also Rebecca Solnit books available tonight. So thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Hammond. Thank you. Thank you very much.